faithfulness in sending your Son to redeem us, to set us free, to be the King of Kings. Father, we're thankful for your Spirit who was given to direct and lead us into the truth. And Father, as we study the books of Kings tonight, I pray that your Spirit would open our eyes and our ears and give us fresh revelation from your word. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. First and Second Kings. We should be able to walk through both of these books. Last week we began looking at 1 and 2 Samuel, and we noticed that in the Septuagint, the name 1 and 2, or in the Septuagint, they are called 1 and 2 Kingdoms, and 1 and 2 Kings is 3 and 4 Kingdoms, or reigns in the Septuagint, the Greek translation. The name comes actually from the Hebrew Bible, Kings. The Jews called it part of the former prophets, the 1 and 2 Kings. The division between the two books comes from the Septuagint, and you would notice, I think, if you just sat down and started reading, you'd get to the end of the 1 Kings and go, what the heck did they do here? Why did they stop it here? Well, it's totally arbitrary. There's nothing inspired about where one ends and the other begins. The break between 2 Samuel and Kings is also arbitrary because they were originally probably all one big long scroll. And so they are just divided up somewhat, I think, for length. Most of the narrative in Kings is told from Judah's perspective, not Israel's, which is helpful to keep in mind as you read through the book. Just like if you were to read a biography of, say, Adolf Hitler, it would be really helpful to know if the writer of the biographer or the biographer was a Nazi or an American or a Jew. It makes a big difference. And so Kings is, much of it is written from Judah's perspective and mostly concerned with the events and special consequences to the land and the kingdom of Judah itself. Jerusalem shows up writ large in the book of Kings. Jerusalem lays at the precise tribal boundary between Benjamin and Judah. It's where most of the events in 1 Kings 1 to 11 take place. 1 Kings also draws attention to countries outside of Israel, beyond its borders. It talks about Tyre of Phoenicia, which is modern-day Lebanon, southern Arabia, which is the Horn of Africa, of course, Egypt, Syria, which is, in the text, is called Aram. That is modern-day Syria. The narrative in 1 Kings 12 to 22 is mainly concerned with the shrines and capitals of the northern kingdom, which has now been split off from Jerusalem. The period of history from Solomon to Ahab is roughly 969 to 852 BC. And that comes toward the end of a long period of international peace. During Solomon's reign and for 150 years after that, there was a long period of international peace, where before that, there was in the year, give or take, 1500 to 2000 BC, the nation of Egypt had tremendous, it was a powerful nation, and the nation of the Hittites, which was north of Israel. But those two nations had decreased in power during this time. So there was somewhat international peace after this time with the northern kingdom. You'll see the rise of the Assyrians, the Chaldeans, and later on the Persians, the Medes and the Persians. And then you will see the Greeks, and finally, the Romans. David's great achievement in the book of Kings, the end of Samuel, has been to throw off the external threats that brought to ruin Saul's kingdom, that is mainly the Philistines. David united all the tribes in a centralized permanent realm, and David began to set up the beginning point, if you will, of a bureaucracy. Thanks, David. But when you administer any organization or country, you have to have some sort of a bureaucracy. But David's greatest failure, not morally, he had those, but his greatest failure as far as the kingdom was concerned was his failure to really determine up front and center who's going to succeed him as king. Because Adonijah tried, Absalom gave it a shot, and finally Solomon seizes the throne, but he basically did it because he had his father's backing, and David did not set that in place beforehand. And if you remember the story, I mean, that was kind of almost seems underhanded a little bit, but Nathan the prophet sends somebody in, and you know, to make sure that Solomon gets the throne. Solomon was a model for a wise king, and he was also a model for a fool. Solomon was wise in the sense of he wrote the Proverbs, he was given great wisdom, but he was foolish in the sense of his enormous ease, his notorious self-indulgence. And, of course, there was that small matter of 300 wives and 700 concubines. That didn't do him any help either. The divided kingdom after Solomon was due to many factors, not just Solomon himself, but the consolidation of power. Where was the power consolidated in David and Solomon? Which tribe? Judah. What about the other 11? Oh, well, Solomon had forced labor that he put on the people. Anytime a king comes to power, guess what you get? Taxes. And so there was taxation. And where was all that wealth going? To Solomon, to the temple, to the tribal land of Judah. And we have a sense of that, don't we? How many of you like paying taxes to Washington so they can blow it and spend $43 million on a gas station? And you go, oh, my word. And that's, so we have a sense, I think, just even experientially of that same just gut, And that's part of what's going on here is that before the monarchy, the tribes kind of worked together. There was this tribal confederacy. Moses, often you read through Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Moses would call the tribal leaders, and they would get them together, and they would decide things, and so there was a sense of we're all in this together, but not after the monarchy came into power. The tribe of Judah got lifted up above the other ones. There was a, because of the temple, there was centralized worship, which on one hand, very clearly, God had even told Moses, you know, you do this, until I tell you where my name will be placed, so to speak. So the place of my name, that phrase sort of shows up. But the result of that within the hearts of many of the people, at least 11 tribes, was, why can't we do it in my town? Why do we have to go to their town? So it just created some issues with the rest of the tribes. So that's part of the roots of the divided kingdom. And some of those roots actually go all the way back to Jacob in Genesis 49, where Jacob gave his blessing to his 12 tribes, or 12 tribes to his 12 sons. And to Judah, even there, he said he will rule over his brothers. You know, talked about the scepter in Genesis 49. So the roots go way back. They weren't just with Solomon and David. Jeroboam, who becomes the ruler of the northern kingdom, is basically a nobody for all intents and purposes. But he's known for no other reason than he was the only northerner previously known to have been a rebel against King Solomon. And so they choose him. After the split, the northern kingdom was going nowhere, so to speak. They had very little sense of self-identity, because even today, where is a Jewish person's identity wrapped up in? What city? Jerusalem. And even today, every year when a Jewish person celebrates Jerusalem, one of the things that they close out the Passover ceremony is next year in Jerusalem. And so that has, I mean, today they don't. I don't think they give it a second thought, but back then, that was the religious center. Solomon had just built his glorious temple. I mean, it was magnificent. And now the northern tribes really have no part in it. And so their kind of sense of self-identity, because their identity for 40 years was God was working on getting Egypt out of them and getting them to find their identity in God himself. Well, God placed his name in the temple. They're now separated from the temple. They're like orphans, if you will, when it came to their religion in some ways. They didn't seem to have much of a covenantal calling after the split. Basically, for all intents and purposes, the people, the tribes of the northern kingdom basically became what we would call secular in their outlook. While the southern kingdom, Judah, did have some sense of national destiny, and that was basically wrapped up in the kingship of David and the image of David. Every king in Judah was judged by whether they had lived up to David's image or not. And actually, even in the southern kingdom, there's only, you know, if you read through Kings, it becomes a common phrase, and they did evil in the sight of the Lord. That's the northern kingdom. Many in the southern kingdom, they did not walk in the ways of their father David. There's only two kings that actually lived up to the image of David. Any guesses? Which one? Close. Go one step farther down. Nope. Josiah and Hezekiah. Were basically the only two that really lived up to the image of David. Kings, as we've said in all of the books so far, is not so much a book of history as it is a book of religion. So the stories that you see in the book of Kings are meant not just to narrate history. So you have to give them that latitude. They're trying to make theological points for the history of the nation. The faith of the nation was being shaped into what would later become a universal faith of Judaism and later on Christianity. A dominant place is given in Kings that tells of the preparation for the temple, its construction, all the stuff that went with it, its dedication. And another interesting thing one author had written was that the nation of Israel was actually, when you think about it, they were actually the first people ever to actually write a history of the people. And at first, that sounds kind of odd because we know, you know, the Egyptians had the hieroglyphics and the cuneiform tablets and some of the other things, the Assyrians. But all of their history was written more in response to their mythology and their worldview of what the gods were doing, while Israel actually wrote history, as we would understand history for the most part, because their history was being written from the viewpoint of what God, Yahweh, was doing in their midst, and how he was shaping them and forming them into a people. Before the temple was built, if you remember reading through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, even Joshua, Judges, God allowed himself to be worshipped wherever he chose. And that would be, if you read toward the end of Numbers, I think Numbers 32, 33, there's this long list, and they camped here, and they camped here, and they camped here. Every single one of those places, through those long list of the journeys, is where God had allowed himself to be worshipped. It was always at the tent of meeting, but it was in very different places. And even once you enter the land, they worshipped at Bethel, at Shiloh, at Gilgal, a number of different places. But once the temple is built, only here. And that's interesting because one of Hezekiah's reforms, if you read through Isaiah, I think it's like Isaiah 36 and following, there's those chapters in there where, I want to say Nebuchadrezzar or Eridan or... Yeah, that guy. You know, he sends his messengers because they've conquered the land up to basically Jerusalem. And one of their things that their taunts against Jerusalem and the king Hezekiah is he's destroyed all the high places. You really think your God is going to, you know, help him? Come on. And what Hezekiah, and that is, in a sense, exactly what Hezekiah did. Because Hezekiah instituted religious reforms in the country to the point that at the time or previous, just previous to Hezekiah, there were other places of worship. Because if you lived in the northern tribe of Dan and you had to travel all the way to Jerusalem, that's a long travel by foot. So there were other places, and there were temples, quote unquote, there were places of worship that had the exact replica in miniature. They had a Holy of Holies. They had the Holy Place. They had an altar of incense. And they would be an exact replica of the temple in Jerusalem. Hezekiah filled them in. Now, what's interesting what Hezekiah did with those places is the pagan high places he would demolish. But they have actually uncovered a place they believe Hezekiah actually just filled in, because it was an exact representation of the temple in Jerusalem, and he did not want to desecrate it, so he just filled it in and said, you've really got to worship over here. And they've uncovered that, and they believe that part of Hezekiah's reforms, which is exactly what I think the Assyrians taunted Jerusalem with. And Hezekiah, your king, has filled in all the high places. Well, again, for them, it meant something very different than for Hezekiah. For them, it was, you know, every land, every mountain, every place had a god. Not so for Hezekiah. So Hezekiah had done some amazing things, but God had caused his place, his name, to be worshipped only in Jerusalem. And that naturally caused some issues coming from a tribal league where all the tribes were equal. Imagine, I mean, if you were to put it in today's vernacular, let's just say, for instance, that starting December 1st, all the EFC churches in Colorado have to worship here. That'd be great. What do you suppose those chaps over in Fort Collins are going to think? They're going to go, excuse what? You got to be kidding me. Can't we just, what? No, you must do it here. Well, all of a sudden you can instantly see, you've got, what? You can instantly see the angst that some of those tribes that lived far off felt And you can see, and you want, and you're taxing me, and I'm building you a temple. You live, what? All of a sudden, you can begin to see the dissension within the ranks. Did they have what?
Synagogue.
No. Synagogues were, that was after the exile. Synagogues didn't come until probably 300 to 400 BC at the earliest. Probably more like 200 to 100 BC is where synagogues came into being. And synagogues, of course, after the temple was destroyed, that's when synagogues took off. I mean, they really, because there was no central place. But even in the synagogues, it's interesting that if you would go to Capernaum today or Bethsaida, Gamla, and see the remains of the temple, stand in the temple, see where the Holy of Holies is placing and hold a compass, it'll point to Jerusalem. All the synagogues are always pointed, wherever they are, to Jerusalem. So, no, synagogues were a much later invention, if you will, or development, I should say, of Judaism. Yes. But remember that back then they had a very different understanding. You know, we have a... If someone doesn't come to church for 3 months, we wonder, you backslider, what's your problem? You know, what's the matter? How many times were all the males required to go to Jerusalem? Three times a year. That's it. They were required to go to Jerusalem to the temple for the three great feasts three times. They didn't go every week. So it was a very different understanding of what it of than what we normally see as normal. Pardon me? Yeah, you could observe the feast at Passover, but Passover would be one of the feasts where all the males, at least, were required to go to Jerusalem. So. If you will hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, then I will bless you. I will protect you. I am the Lord your God. It was, you're very right. It's a good observation, because that in itself was, to do that was an act of faith. Because you're right. All your men of war would go to Jerusalem. And so when you think about it in those terms, it was an act of faith to observe the sacrifice or the feast.
Did they talk among their families? I mean, if we only went to three times a year, we would be very, calling the word, backslidden. We would become more and more secular.
It was, yeah, that's true. Well, read the Book of Kings. Yes. And that's where even, I think there was a recognition of some of that on their part, and that's why even today, you know, how often do Jews gather every week? The same as we do. They do it on Saturday. But they do it the same. And for them, it's become much more intense even than where we are now. You know, we have a Wednesday night Bible study and call her good. You know, they'd get together and study Torah all the time. So that was, I think, a further development in their religious life. But God only commanded all the males three times a year. But part of that was, the difference there is, they did not have a paid, take that back. they did have a paid clergy in the sense of all the Levitical tribe got paid from the first fruits and the tithes, and that's what they got paid from. But beyond that, the Levitical tribe was really there to service the temple. The sacrifices, to receive the sacrifices, to go through all the rituals and all that stuff. That was not, but their primary purpose was not there to teach. Okay? The primary teaching happened between you two in the home. When you, you know, and you would... No.
That was
no. Because scrolls, you know, when they found the book of the law in King Josiah, that was probably the only one. Mm-hmm. So they were very, very few because it took so long to transcribe them. So much of the teaching then was done in the homes. So that was the primary avenue of teaching. And I would submit to you today, that's where it still should be. You can, you know, some of you know or have been to church, and you go, yeah, Grandma took me to church, to Sunday school, and sat my little behind down there, and yeah, okay, you got it. But then you went home, and there may have been nothing. What did you pick up on? What Grandma brought you, or the nothing? Generally, it was the nothing, because that was, well, 6 days and 23 hours. And you had 1 hour at church, and you're going, okay. So a very different understanding of religious instruction than what we have today. It's interesting, we're talking about the author of Kings, that as you read through the book of 1st and 2nd, he chastises much less the idolatries of Judah's kings than he does of the kings of Israel. In the book of Kings, the role of the prophet was coming to the forefront with Elijah and Elisha. Israel's prophets, it's interesting to note, had much in common with other nations' prophets of the time. Other nations had prophets just like Israel. They would speak for their God. They would have ecstatic experiences, and you see that in 1 Kings 18 with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. You know, they're cutting themselves, they're in this frenetic experience trying to get their God to do something. And so they have found writings of the Assyrians and stuff where they had prophets that functioned much like Israel's prophets at the time. When Elijah appears, it appears that he comes to the forefront basically to oppose the worship of Baal. And what is Elijah basically known for? What did he do on Mount Carmel?
Well, he slain the
400 prophets.
Yeah, or he hadn't burned up the stone.
Exactly. And what's interesting is when we were in Israel, we were at Mount Carmel. And Ray told one of the guys there, he said, "Don't say anything. Give me about 10 minutes." Okay. So we're just wandering around this 2,000-year-old olive grove. I mean, these old, big, gnarly trees. And Ray gets up on the mountain, 500 feet up there, I don't know, not too far, and all of a sudden, "Israel, choose you this day whom you will serve. If Baal is God, serve him. If Yahweh is God, serve him." We all stood there. Now, by this time, we've been with Ray long enough to know, okay, the answer is in the text. Where's my Bible? And so we're trying to find the answer, you know. And we get all done, and Ray says, "You gave the right answer." We said, "What?" Because it says right there in the text, "And the people answered him nothing." We thought, oh, good. We got it by default. But anyway. But Elijah shows up to oppose the prophets, the worship of Baal. The prophet seems to appear at times of crisis to interpret the times for the people, for the will of God for his people. In 1 Kings, the prophet Nathan directs most of the first scene of the book, and while the prophet Micaiah ends the book with Jehoshaphat. So prophets show up. As far as the author of the book of Kings, 1 and 2, the Talmud assigns the author of Kings to Jeremiah in the writings of the Talmud, because you can go home, make a note, Jeremiah 52, and 2 Kings 24:18 to 25:30 are basically exactly the same. Almost word for word. Pardon me? Jeremiah 52 and 2 Kings 24 verse 18 through 25 verse 30. Most scholars today do not consider Jeremiah to be the author. They call him a Deuteronomistic editor, much as we talked about with Samuel, Joshua, and Judges. He's writing from the viewpoint, the school of Deuteronomy, so to speak, the book of the law, kind of as a backdrop. Most likely, the author is a contemporary of King Josiah and revised later by someone living during the exile. The author, it seems, used some source material which appears actually in 1 Kings. 1 Kings 11, verse 41, talks about a book of the Acts of Solomon. 1 Kings 14:29 talks about a book of the Chronicles of Judah's kings. And 1 Kings 15:31 talks about a book of the Chronicles of the Israelite kings. So it's very possible that these three books serve as a foundational source material for the entire book of Kings. The date of the book of 1 and 2 Kings, well, that's one thing we're fairly close on, and that is in 2 Kings verse 25, or verse 2 Kings chapter 25 verse 27. It says, in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he became king, released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. Well, we know that was in the year 561 AD. So most scholars, with that in mind, believe they date to book, give or take, right around 550, 560, somewhere right in there. So this is one of the first books that we can be somewhat close, I think, on the date of the book itself. 1 and 2 Kings covers a period of roughly 400 years. So there's a lot of history covered in this time period. The general outline, you can stick that in your Bible, shrink it down, whatever. We're not going to walk through that, but you can see all the various different kings. Some of the theological themes. First of all, like king, like nation. Rulers have a powerful influence on a nation. Rulers have a powerful influence, whether they be CEOs, presidents, governors, mayors, you name it, on a people. There's generally a clear correlation in the spiritual state of the king and that of the people whom he leads. And you will see that throughout organizations. The greater the immorality, the greater the sinfulness of the king, the people just head on downhill, man. If a godly king rules, the people fear the Lord. When an evil king reigns, the people tend to fall into greater immorality and idolatry. And you see that, you know, Proverbs talks about righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach unto her. And much of that starts with the guy on top. And so, like John Maxwell says, it's lonely at the top, so you'd better know why you're there. And that's true for kings also. We see that there's a common refrain for the kings of Israel was the fact that they did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, by which he made Israel to sin. And when you read that, you go, excuse me? You're pinning all the blame for Israel's sins on the king? Jeroboam? Yes. Remember, that's their theological interpretation of why the northern king slid into idolatry. Or they didn't slide into idolatry. They took a shortcut. You know, what did the first thing King Jeroboam do? Make some golden calves. The prophets was another the themes. God raised up prophets in response to the wickedness of the kings to sort of serve, we're familiar with the term, check and balance against them. The prophets were passionate in their insistence on undivided allegiance to the Lord and the law. They opposed any allegiance for political posturing that might jeopardize the distinctiveness of Israelite religion. A prophet's strict adherence to the covenant often pits the prophet against the king. And you see that with Elijah. He kills the prophets of Baal. Says, Ahab, better get in your chariot. The rain's coming. And what is the very next thing that Jezebel does? By this day tomorrow, your head will be removed from your shoulders, dude. So there was just this clash between king and prophet. It was a theme of the prophet's message was God's law, that God is a God of covenant, and that goes into the covenantal aspect. But let me finish with the prophet one, and that is Elisha and Elijah received the greatest attention. But there was a number of other prophets, if you read through 1 and 2 Kings. There's Nathan, Ahijah, Shemaiah, Micaiah. The prophet Jonah actually shows up in the Book of Kings. Isaiah, Huldah, the prophetess. And in 1 Kings 13, the man of God, with the no name, man of God, who speaks, at the very least, prophetically. There's the issue, the theme of covenant, and again, that shows up throughout the Old Testament. That was basically the theme of the covenant of the prophet's message. Remember, Israel, God made this covenant with us. And that's one thing we'll be looking at, I think, on Sunday morning, is that whole sense of covenant that if God made a covenant with Abraham, was the covenant with Abraham only? Ah, yes, it was. So Abraham basically served as a representative of all the nations, or about, not the nation, of all the peoples to come. When the people stood at Mount Sinai, God made a covenant with them. They declared all that the Lord has said, we will do. It didn't work out so well, but nonetheless, the covenant was still in force 400 years later, because it was to them and their descendants. And so, again, that's something that's a little foreign to us, because we would go, I didn't make that covenant. That was Grandpa. Don't look at me. You know, but they don't think like we do. That whole issue of covenant. And we see that, you see that in the Book of Kings, the curses of the covenant come upon the people. Or the blessings, depending on. And King Josiah, what did God, the prophet came to King Josiah and said, I'm going to wipe this nation out. But because you followed after me, it will not happen in your days. So that was the blessing, was basically the blessing for Israel at the time was an extension of the time of mercy until judgment would fall. So you see that whole theme of covenant. The whole theme of the sovereignty of God, again and again and again, God's rule over the kingdoms of the earth is made very clear. God leads his people into battle. He answers their prayers. He honors their sacrifices. He displays a special concern for the poor, for the oppressed, when the people cry out. But again and again and again, you see the sovereignty of God coming through in the book of Kings, through the rising up of kings, the putting down of kings, and again and again. The issue of temple. The temple is built. Scholars believe about roughly 480 years after the exile, after the Exodus. And there can be only one temple, only one place for the people of God. One central sanctuary is now allowed. Worship at all other places is prohibited. So the problem for Israel is not so much a wholesale abandonment of God for other gods, but combining the worship of God with that of other gods. The whole issue of syncretism, of bringing, because when King Jeroboam, if you read the book of King Jeroboam comes to power, and what is his first inclination is, well, you know, we can only worship at the temple. Well, that's no good, because I don't want my people going over there. So I'm going to put a calf at Bethel and up at Dan. And then they can worship there. Now, they're still, in his mind, worshiping Yahweh. But all of a sudden, you see the instant combining, because God had clearly said, you shall have no other gods. You shall not make any graven images. And the calf, the bull, was a very common sign of pagan worship, because a bull represented for the ancients the sign of fertility. And so it wasn't that they just walked away from God so much as they just, well, it was God plus. God plus fill in the blank. Whatever else we could add to it. And that's, I would submit to you, in some ways that is a challenge even for us today. Now, we don't think in these terms, but let's be honest. If I came here next week and preached in shorts, some people would have a problem. You see? Because we have God plus, you got to wear the right clothes. And if we had to sit on steel chairs, yeah, you did that already. Been there, done that. But all of a sudden, we begin to see that our traditions can almost get raised to the point of, it's God plus. And so we too, I would submit to you, have to be very careful about our stuff versus who God is and what does he actually require.
What about the God minus?
Well, that's a whole nother issue.
Yeah.
Yes. There is a proper way. But and finally, the division of the land was a theme. And we talked about that, the dividing of the land between the northern and southern kingdoms. Genesis 49 talked about that, that Judah would rule. And then it's interesting because the people came to Samuel, we want a king. Yeah, right. And how often doesn't it happen? We want this. Okay, but let's think that through. What does that mean? Well, no, don't go there. We just want it now. Let's check the brains at the door. We just want it now. And they got what they deserved. They got Saul. And they got a centralized place to worship, which didn't work out so well for them. And it really wasn't until after the exile, when they came back, the remnant came back, that they realized, this isn't so much about our tribal identity so much as it is about our one God. And the tribal identities sort of began to very much decrease in value after the exile. For some, that is still a big deal. It would have some value even today when there are Jewish people that are preparing for the third temple, that you must be of the tribe of Levi. And so you would have to prove your Levitical lineage. So yes, in some aspect, that would still be important. Other tribes, not so much, but that tribe would be front and center in case they build another temple. That's true. Yeah. That's a lot of that's just been lost to history. Pardon me?
When Jerusalem was burned, wasn't a lot of that destroyed?
Oh, sure. The records, the genealogical records, sure. Yeah. They might. Let's not go there. The issue of Jesus Christ in the book of Kings, Kings ends, if you will, with despair and destruction. And the hope of Kings is for a new covenant, for a new king, and ultimately for a kingdom. Some closing notes on the book of Kings. You'll notice as you read through that the author has highlighted the good deeds and at times downplays the evil deeds of Judah's kings. And in the end pins all the blame for Judah's ruin on one king, Manasseh. Concerning the kings of the northern kingdom, the author finds precious little to say that's good about any of them. There was King Ahab. As one preacher said, he was the biggest toad to ever squat on the throne of Israel. And it was a good day when Ahab died. The chronology of the kings, anybody ever tried to figure out who served when, what, where, why? And just if you want to like become bald. And let me give you a little bit of a clue of why that is so difficult to, even today, for scholars to figure out when the king served. Here's some of the reasons why. Rehoboam and Jeroboam began their reigns in the same time, but we don't know the exact date. The northern kingdom counted the reign of a king by a method that ascribed the last year of the reign to the dying king, but at the same time counted it for his successor, thus producing 1 year too many in each reign. Judah's kings used a different method of reckoning, which a new reign was not counted until the following new year, thus producing a more accurate year count from reign to reign. The Judah scribes switched to the northern method under the influence of the house of Ahab, and later dropped it in returning to the original method they used to use. The Israelite kings counted their years from a new year in the spring, while the Judah kings counted from a new year in the fall. Jehoshaphat may have been co-regent with his father Asa, counting his reign from that date. And his son Jehoram may have been co-regent with him. So put all those things together, and you have a nightmare. That wasn't what I was trying to do, but so with all that said, the Chronicles of the Kings is very difficult to determine at best. First and Second King paints a picture of people who are constantly fall into idol worship, of a monarchy that is basically ineffective, and a majority of the kings who are wicked. At the close of 2 Kings, the kingdoms have been destroyed. Both kingdoms have been destroyed by foreign powers. The people have been exiled for the most part. And the end of the book is a picture of despair and hopelessness. Their temple has been destroyed. They started out with the building of the temple in 1 Kings, and they end up with no temple. They start out with David and Solomon. They end up with a bunch of wicked toads that have squatted on the throne. There's at least 14 different pagan deities that are mentioned in 1 and 2 Kings. Yep. From Adrammelech to Anemelech, Ashima, Ashtoreth, Baal-Zebub, Chemosh, Milcom, Nehushtan, Nergal, Nibhaz, Ramon, Sukkoth, Benoth, and Tartak. Just in case you wondered.
I did.
I bet you did. Tartak. Questions? Observations?
Comments.
About kings? Yes.
I disagree with you on the dates of the kings.
You have the right to disagree with me. And some scholars have questions with his work, too.
I know. He did the initial work.
Yep.
Reconciling all this confusion. He did make some errors. And there are some, and I don't have the names at my fingertips right now, but I can get them. Because I just read about this past week.
Right.
Subsequently, they've been able to pin down pretty much the dates. With Thiele's work and with his subsequent
revisions and stuff, yeah. And it's interesting because you could look up dates of the kings in six different places and probably come up. They're going to be similar. You'll come up with some differences. But what's interesting is many of the dates that they've actually come up with the dating of some of them has come from actually foreign sources, not from the biblical text. From archaeology, they dug up tablets of a library in Assyria and other places where they know the dates that those kings served, and they have them dated and stuff. And so my point would be for you and I to sit down and try to figure out this out without the help of a scholar, like you mentioned, would be.
Well, I agree.
It'd be a real challenge.
They have narrowed it down.
Yes, that is true.
Very, very close.
They're pretty close on the years. Yep. Yes. All the way down to, down to the exile. So. Other questions, comments, observations? Yep. Yep. And some of them, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think the Book of Mormon put some of those lost tribes actually down in Peru, in South America, too.
The whole idea of them being lost is that they lost their identity.
Yes.
And they were in exile, and that's why they don't know why they're...
Right. And what's interesting about the tribes is you read through the book of kings, and the first number of books in the Bible, and you get the names of the 12 tribes from Genesis, and then go to the book of Revelation, mm-hmm. and the tribe of Dan is missing, and nobody knows why. It's just an interest. But anyway. What was the name of it?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, the Worldwide Church of God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Ted Armstrong. Anyway.
Yes.
Anyway, if you go into the gospel, you will see instances where people are mentioned and says what tribe they're from. What happened is a lot of the godly people up in the northern kingdom migrated to Judah and vice versa.
Right.
Because they wanted to be close to the temple and others wanted to be...
There's no doubt that that happened.
There's a lot of cross-migration.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So the only tribe that we know of that people know what they are pretty much is the priestly...
The Aaronic, yeah, the Levitical tribe, that's true. Yeah.
That has been somehow preserved, and I don't know the details.
That I don't know. Other questions? The woman at the well in John 4, she was a Samaritan.
Yeah.
And they were considered half-breeds. I mean, okay. And that's a nice way of putting it. Well, we are in church, I mean, you know.
Wrong side of the track.
And many of them, the Assyrians left as deportees back into the land. But they were, because even today there's a Samaritan Pentateuch, which is a Samaritan version of the first five books of the Bible.
Sure.
And the Samaritan Pentateuch versus the Masoretic text. And so there's differences between them, but it's interesting that Jesus says, you know, you worship here, but we Jews. Jesus calls himself a Jew. We know where we're supposed to worship, and it's not here. It's there.
Right, and then he changed it.
Yes.
Where you worship God
in spirit and in truth. True worshipers, yes. And I think that the fulfillment of that came with the tearing of the veil in the temple and, you know, ultimately the destruction of the temple.